sermon. We're at Judges chapter 4. Zach's remarks make a good segue to our text this evening, and you'll see that and how that is as we proceed. Now, we have begun our studies in the narrative of individual judges, having so far considered Othniel, whose career is given only in a sketch, then Ehud and Shamgar, who make something of a pair. Shamgar, remember, may not have been an Israelite judge, per se, but even if not, he was a man the Lord used to deliver his people from an oppressor. Later in the Bible, remember, even Cyrus, the Persian emperor, will be described in Isaiah as the Lord's servant. He was not Yahweh's servant because he intended to be, but because the Lord used him to restore his people to the promised land. We've noticed in general that the presentation of the career of each judge is according to the formula that was introduced in the prologue. We'll find in each case more or less the same basic sequence as we were given in the summary material in chapter 2, often in the same or at least similar wording. Israel's apostasy, her subjugation by an oppressor, her appeal to the Lord, his raising up for her a deliverer, his delivering Israel, and finally the ensuing peace that lasts for the time of that judge's life. There are other broad themes that tie these narratives together. In the narrative of Ehud, we took note of the emphasis on concursus, that the narrator insists at one and the same time that the deliverance of God's people comes from God, even as it is the achievement of the men whom God raised up. Both are celebrated, God's grace and mercy and power on the one hand, and the cleverness or the strength or the daring do of the judge on the other. This will be a characteristic feature of the following accounts of each of the judges as we read them. We'll be introduced to another of the broad themes that tie these various narratives together in the book in this next account we're reading this evening concerning Barak. Judges 4 and 5 provide the relatively rare phenomenon of the same event reported in two versions, one in prose, the other in poetry. These two chapters offer students of Old Testament literature an invaluable resource for examining the differences between Hebrew prose and Hebrew poetry. The only parallel, really, to this juxtaposition of prose and poetic accounts of the same event is found in Exodus 14 and 15, where again we have two accounts, one prose, one poetry, this time of Israel crossing the Red Sea. Some of the differences between prose and poetry in the Bible are the same as the differences that separate those two very different forms of literature today. Prose generally uses words commonly used in everyday speech and uses common grammar and syntax. Sentences tend to be longer and more complex with more subordinate clauses. Poetry uses an elevated literary style. Archaic words are more often found, archaic expressions, and both creative and compressed grammar and syntax are characteristic of poetry in English as well as in Hebrew. For example, in Hebrew poetry, the sign of the direct object and the common conjunction introducing subordinate clauses, which are both words that are pronounced in the sentence, disappear in poetry. Poetry, therefore, is a more condensed or compressed style of writing. Hebrew prose is more matter-of-fact, literal, precise, logical. Hebrew poetry is more impressionistic, and as we have learned, is heavily dependent on the use of parallelism. Hebrew prose is written more to inform, educate, indoctrinate. Hebrew poetry, more often to celebrate, commemorate, and inspire. After Ehud died, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Our formula again, as in 3 verse 12 and 3 verse 7. God's gracious deliverance of his people had not lessened, much less had it destroyed Israel's attraction to the paganism of the people of Canaan, among whom she was now living, because she had not faithfully fulfilled the summons, the charge, the commandment that God had given her as she entered the promised land to drive out or exterminate the Canaanite peoples. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, a king of Canaan who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Now, the reference to Jabin, king of Hazor, poses a problem. The reason is that in Joshua chapter 11, verses 1 to 15, we read of Joshua's victory over Jabin, king of Hazor, of his having killed Jabin, and of his having burned the city. The name Jabin is not really the problem, for it is in any case likely to have been a dynastic name for the kings of Hazor rather than the personal name of only one of those kings. Hazor dominated the valley north of the Sea of Galilee for 5 centuries until it was destroyed by Joshua. It was not rebuilt until the days of Solomon, when it became an important northern Israelite fortification. So how could Hazor, destroyed and burned by Joshua, hold Israel hostage for 20 years until the victory under Barak? In all likelihood, Hazor, though burned, and this is important to our understanding of what is happening in Judges, in all likelihood, Hazor was not as decisively defeated as Joshua 11, taken by itself, might lead us to believe. We've been gathering that the accounts of Israel's conquest of the land under Joshua left more room than we might have thought at the time, not only for the survival of Canaanite peoples in a particular city or a particular area, but their survival in strength. Nothing in Joshua 11 requires us to believe that no member of the royal family escaped, or that in time some royal figure did not return to what was left of the city to reassert his rule. All the more is this true given Israel's failure to consolidate her control of the promised land, the territory that she had conquered, at least to some degree. Fact is, Judges has already reminded us that large numbers of Canaanites remained in the land and reorganized themselves and continued their political life after Israel's penetration of their territory and settlement in it. Excuse me. Remember particularly, for example, what we read in chapter 1, verses 22 through 26, how the city of Lutz was destroyed, but soon rebuilt nearby by a survivor and allowed to do so by the indolence and the spirit of accommodation that had overtaken the Israelites after their initial zeal had begun to flag. Lutz was destroyed, so it reads, but sure enough, it nevertheless survived and was renewed and exercised a Canaanite influence over Israel in that part of the country. Remember also that the oppression described here in verse 3 may have been largely local in effect. That is, Hazor did not exercise control over the entire nation of Israel, but only some of its parts, and the pressure would have been felt primarily by the northernmost tribes. Sisera's name suggests to scholars of such things that he may have been a mercenary, not local, a general for hire. As we've learned already in chapter 1, verse 19, Israel in her present condition spiritually was no match for a force of iron chariots. She should have been. The Lord certainly could have given her victory, but she had no faith. This accounts for the fact that the eventual battle would take place on the plains where chariot forces could be deployed. We read that in chapter 4, verse 13. In any case, information about Sisera at this point early in the narrative indicates that Jabin is going to remain in the background in the following narrative. And that is precisely what happens. Because he had 900 chariots, iron chariots, and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried to the Lord for help. Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lappidot, was leading Israel at that time. In this instance, we do not have the explicit statement that we have in a number of the other narratives of the judges to the effect that the Lord raised up a deliverer for Israel. What we have instead in verses 4 through 10 is an account of how, in this particular case, the Lord did raise up a deliverer for Israel. Remember, concursus is assumed. The Lord's unseen hand is orchestrating these events. As a prophetess, Deborah was a spokeswoman in Israel for the Lord. There are several other women prophets named in the Bible. You remember Miriam, Moses' sister, who's called a prophetess in Exodus 15:20, and Huldah in 2 Kings 22:14. Anna, who saw the infant Jesus in the temple, is also called a prophetess in Luke chapter 1, though it is not entirely clear what is meant by that title in that context, because we know that it is the teaching both of the Bible and the general confession of Judaism in that time that there had been no prophecy since the days of Malachi in Israel. In keeping with the biblical understanding of men and women in marriage, Deborah, though a prophetess, is identified with reference to her husband. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites came to her to have their disputes decided. Have their disputes decided is a paraphrase. It literally reads in the Hebrew, for the judgment. The text says that she was judging Israel at that time. The verb used is the verbal form of the noun, judge. And the description of her activity, as the NIV renders the text, seems to indicate that she really was serving as a judge. She had a judicial occupation. As we noted in a previous study, this is the only instance of the use of the word group judge or judging in the book in which actual judging seems to be involved, the deciding of cases. That fact has led a number of scholars to suggest that it may be better to take have their disputes decided literally for the judgment, as I said, as it reads in Hebrew, to mean not that she was hearing cases day after day. People would come to her with their disputes and she would make a judicial decision about them. But rather, the words should be taken to mean that she was pronouncing an answer to the cry that the Israelites had raised to God for help. They came to her to learn, in this particular instance, what God would say in answer to their appeal. That is, here too, judgment has not to do with the work of a day-to-day court, but with the question of Israel's deliverance from oppression. Everywhere else in the book, that's what judge and judging and judgment means. Perhaps it means that here as well. On the other hand, the narrative makes it very clear that Deborah was not Israel's deliverer. This is not her role in this narrative. She is not a judge in the same sense in which Gideon and Jephthah and Othniel and Samson our judges. That role in this narrative is filled by Barak. She's not said to be summoned to the task of delivering Israel on the Lord's behalf. It's not said that Deborah delivered Israel from oppression, as it is said with respect to the other judges. She appears not to have had any particular role in the actual battle, though the poet may suggest that she was present at the battle in chapter 5, verse 15. The narrative in chapter 4, verses 14 to 16, when we get there, does not explicitly say that she was. And she's not identified as the savior of Israel, but as a mother in Israel in chapter 5, verse 7. Interestingly, in later lists of Israel's deliverers, those in 1 Samuel chapter 12, verses 9 to 11, and Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, Barak is mentioned, but Deborah is not. She sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun, the northernmost tribes, and lead the way to Mount Tabor." Now the attention shifts from Deborah, the prophetess who has been told what the Lord intends to do, to Barak, through whom the deliverance will actually come. It's clear that she sent for Barak on the Lord's instructions, though that isn't explicitly said. We're not told anything as to why God chose Barak for this particular assignment, just as we're not told why he chose Gideon or Jephthah or Samson or Othniel or any of the other judges. He was of the tribe of Naphtali, which was one of the tribes bearing the brunt of Hazor's oppression. Mount Tabor rises steeply from the floor of the Jezreel Valley, some 1,843 feet. So you Covenant College students can think of Lookout Mountain and the valley that lies beneath it. The mountain controlled one of the most important crossroads in that region. So here we have God indicating the strategy that is to be used in defeating Hazor. "I will lure Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army." This is what the God of Israel is saying. "I will lure Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops, to the Kishon River and give him into your hands." God is in control of even Sisera's army. In fact, the verb the NIV translates lure in verse 7 is the same verb it translates take in verse 6. As Barak deploys his army, the Lord will deploy Sisera's army so as to lead it into defeat. The Kishon River drains the Jezreel Valley, indicating that the battle will be fought in the valley. And the best way to bring Sisera's army out to fight is to give him an opportunity to deploy his chariots, make him feel as though he has definitely the upper hand in the contest. Chariots, of course, are unsuitable to mountainous terrain, and chariot armies never wanted to fight in such terrain, and usually would not. Barak said to her, "If you go with me, I will go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go." It may strike us at first as a confession of faith, but as a matter of fact, it's cowardice. Barak's hesitation was cowardice, and the narrator wants us to know that, and Deborah's response is going to make it clear to us that it was. His desire to have the prophetess accompany him was the expression of his lack of confidence in the word that she had given to him from the Lord. He wanted to be sure that he could continue to get instructions. He thought of Deborah as kind of a charm, a talisman. And to sustain the weak-kneed Barak, Deborah offers him a sign. The Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman. The reader at this point imagines that the woman will be Deborah herself. It proves not to be, in a most unexpected and striking way. And in this way, Barak will know that it was the Lord, not Deborah, not his confidence that comes from having Deborah with him. It will be the Lord who delivers Israel when this particular and unusual sign appears. "Very well," Deborah said, "I will go with you, but because of the way you are going about this, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman." So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh, where he summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. 10,000 men followed him, and Deborah also went with him. The narrator doesn't say so, but he seems to imply that the men followed Barak by the thousands, at least in part, because Deborah was going along. Her presence with Barak would be somehow the indication that the Lord would be with the army, like when Israel took the Ark of the Covenant into battle with her. Another bad idea. That unbelieving Israel would care for such a thing is another evidence that when God delivers his people, not even their own spiritual failure can deter him. Now, Heber the Kenite had left the other Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent by the great tree in Zaananim, near Kadesh. Now here the narrator anticipates the unfolding of the account of the battle and supplies some information beforehand that would have interrupted the flow of his story had he been required to supply it later. So he's giving this to you to set the stage. Simply put, Heber was an independent man. He'd left the arid south where his family lived in the territory of Judah, and he'd moved to greener pastures among the people of Naphtali. When they told Sisera that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera gathered together his 900 iron chariots and all the men with him from Haroshet Hagoyim to the Kishon River. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Go. This is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you?" So Barak went down Mount Tabor, followed by 10,000 men. Yahweh himself, through his prophetess, gives the order to march, promises victory. Now Deborah's work is done, and she disappears from the narrator, or from the narration. At Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword, and Sisera abandoned his chariot and fled on foot. That phrase, the Lord routed Sisera, that we might refer to as what we often called in Genesis the evaluative viewpoint, the statement of interpretation and explanation provided by the narrator so you will be certain to get his theological message. This is what the Lord did. Armies are deployed, a battle is joined, fighting goes on, but it is the Lord who routs the enemies of his people. But in chapter 5, verse 20, a good verse to put in the margin against verse 15, the poet, in his poetic way, will put it this way: "From the heavens the stars fought, from their courses they fought against Sisera." But Barak pursued the chariots and army as far as Haroshet Hagoyim. All the troops of Sisera fell by the sword. Not a man was left. Barak, concerned primarily, as perhaps a general would naturally be, with the army fleeing before him, pursues it, and so lets Sisera escape. Sisera, however, fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, because there were friendly relations between Jabed, king of Hazor, and the clan of Heber the Kenite. Not only had Heber separated from his own clan in the south, who were allies of Israel, but he had formally bound himself by a treaty, the much stronger sense of the words the NIV translates as friendly relations, had bound himself by a treaty to Hazor, Israel's enemy. By all political and ethical standards, therefore, Sisera should have been safe with Heber. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid." So he entered her tent, and she put a covering over him. Like Eglon last time with Ehud, Sisera is seduced by Jael's speech and pretend kindness. "I'm thirsty," he said. "Please give me some water." She opened a skin of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him up. Why she substituted the milk for the water isn't absolutely clear. Did she want him to go to sleep faster and gave him milk on the assumption that that would have a soporific effect? Was she trying to lull him into a false sense of security by the impression that she wanted to do the very best by him, give him more than he asked for? Probably something like that. "Stand in the doorway of the tent," he told her. "If someone comes by and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say no." Strange question to anticipate. After all, any man in Jael's tent who was not her husband should not be there. Sisera does not appear to be a man who cared a fig for other people. Certainly, he cared nothing for a woman's reputation. But Jael, Heber's wife, picked up a tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. She drove the peg through his temple into the ground, and he died. Barak came by in pursuit of Sisera, and Jael went out to meet him. "Come," she said, "I will show you the man you're looking for." So he went in with her, and there lay Sisera with a tent peg through his temple, dead. Now, Barak had now mopped up operations against Sisera's army, and he's looking for the general himself. Given what has been said before, it seems likely that we're to picture Barak as eager to capture Sisera and get the glory for himself. He was hoping to disprove Deborah's earlier prophecy that the glory would go to a woman himself, that he's hot on the trail of Sisera, and then Jael comes out and in a sentence bursts his bubble. The Lord's prophecy has been fulfilled. Sisera was delivered into Barak's hands, as we read in verse 7, but the honor for the victory did not go to Barak, as we read in verse 9. In chapter 5's great poem, Jael will be celebrated. She's not an Israelite. She's not a man. She's not a warrior. But it's she who does in Sisera, Israel's nemesis. It's not clear, however, what she did was motivated by any regard for the Lord or for the people of Israel. She violated all the canons of statecraft and hospitality and social convention. What Heber thought about what his wife had done, where Heber was during all of this time, what Barak thought about it is left unsaid. Just the simple fact that it was this non-Israelite woman who put paid to Israel's enemy. On that day, God subdued Jabin, the Canaanite king, before the Israelites, and the hand of the Israelites grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, the Canaanite king, until they destroyed him. Once again, the author reminds us that what we have just read is primarily about what God did, not about the exploits of these characters, Deborah, Barak, or Jael. Contrary to many modern studies, as you perhaps can imagine, the chapter is not about sexual politics or the conflict between men and women. It's not an early feminist tract, but an account of the conflict between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of darkness and God's sovereign rule over his enemies. The battle just concluded did not entirely destroy Jabin and Hazor's power, but it weakened it so that total destruction would come in due time. Now, we spent a long time clarifying the text because I wanted to be sure that we appreciated what it was we were reading and what the author was saying to us with his narrative. Last time, we considered a theme that is characteristic of all the narratives of the Judges, namely that of concursus, the same deliverance of Israel being both the work of God and of man, each being a real cause, each worth remembering and celebrating and paying attention to. God uses means to accomplish his will. Tonight we have before us another characteristic feature of all of these narratives of the Judges, and certainly increasingly of the narratives that are now to come, one after another in the book. Namely, the flawed character of the Judges themselves. We start with Barak, who was a man of weak faith, to some significant degree a coward. We know that because the narrator takes pains to let us hear Deborah say that to his face in verse 9. And the point of Barak's unworthiness is then confirmed by the fact that the climactic deed, the execution of the general enemy, is performed not by Barak, who wanted to perform it, not even by an Israelite, but by a Kenite woman. God took the honor of total victory, and it was total victory. God took that honor away from Barak and gave it to a foreign woman because Barak proved himself unworthy of the honor. In other words, the emphasis in this narrative, as it will be in the succeeding narratives of the Judges, falls on the total victory that the Lord achieved on behalf of Israel, but achieved through a flawed and unworthy servant. If we have questions or had questions somewhat about Ehud's character after reading of his exploits, the questions are removed in Barak's case. The narrator tells us straight away of his hesitancy and his cowardice. And what is true of Barak will continue to be the case and in ever increasing measure in regard to Gideon, and then to Jephthah, and then finally to Samson. They are Israel's deliverers, to be sure. Heroes they are not, except in a very attenuated sense. They are men of faith. The Bible says they are, and leaves us in no doubt about that. Barak is listed in the same breath with Samuel and David in Hebrews chapter 11. They are men of faith, but they are weak men. In some significant degree, they are unworthy men. They are men with serious defects of character. I was recently reading Arthur Herman's book, How the Scots Invented the Modern World. Maybe you've seen that book. If it was the Irish who saved civilization, apparently it was the Scots who invented the modern world. But at the very beginning of that interesting book, Herman tells the story of 18-year-old Thomas Aikenhead, a smart-aleck theology student in Edinburgh in 1696, who was accused of blasphemy, indicted, tried, and sentenced to be executed. No matter that this was his first offense, no matter that he retracted all of his statements, no matter that he pled for forgiveness, no matter that he was so young and so impressionable, no matter, as it turned out, that his last words while standing on the scaffold were, "It is my earnest desire that my blood may give a stop to that raging spirit of atheism which has taken such a footing in Britain. And now, O Lord, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, into thy hands I commend my spirit." What arrested my attention in Arthur Herman's account of this sad trial and hanging was the name of Thomas Haliburton among those demanding the boy's execution. Always grieves me to find a hero of mine on the wrong side of some question or doing something unworthy of the Lord, his name, and his cause. Haliburton was the son of a Covenanter pastor. He was later a professor of theology at St. Andrews, wrote several important works of theology. John Newton once said that he wouldn't part with Haliburton's great work against deism for its weight in gold. He is most famous for his spiritual autobiography, published posthumously, Memoirs of the Life of Thomas Haliburton, one of the classics of Scottish, really of all Presbyterian theological writing. I've quoted from Haliburton's memoirs in any number of sermons preached here over the years. Now, Haliburton was himself quite a young man when he weighed in on Thomas Aikenhead's conviction and death sentence. Everybody was a young man in those days. He was only 22 years at the time. But of course, Haliburton was only 38 years old at the time of his death. But his own family had suffered persecution unjustly. After his father had been cast out of his pastorate following the restoration of Charles II in 1662, and after the death of his father, young Thomas and his mother fled to Holland. He only returned to Scotland when the coast was clear again. We might well have felt that such a man would have been particularly sympathetic to the situation of a young man who was, after all, unabashedly repentant and publicly sorrowful for the things that he had so foolishly said under the influence of his peers. But not so. Aikenhead, this inconsiderable trifler, Haliburton described him, had broken the law. He had to be punished. We might well have thought that the Covenanters, who had suffered so cruelly at the hands of an oppressive state, would be very cautious about the use of state power to crush religious dissent. But it was not so. Well, it's not the first time I've learned that great Christians of the past had feet of clay. Whether it was Jerome's brittle and so easily wounded pride, his penchant for the public criticism of other Christian ministers, very often men more worthy than he, or Calvin's temper, or Luther's too violent condemnation of his theological enemies, including the Jews, or Whitfield's fawning over people with titles. Church history is chock full of Christians who were used of God to accomplish great things, but who had embarrassing defects. And alongside all the defects of character and behavior, are those also of thought and conviction. From Jerome's ridiculous and harmful dismissing of marriage as a second-class life for Christians, to the American Presbyterian Robert Dabney's chilling defense of Southern slavery. Every Christian leader is not a Barrack, to be sure. There have been men and women of the noblest bravery who have, through the ages, fought the good fight of faith without wavering. Every Christian is not a Gideon or a Jephthah or a Samson in terms of their specific failures and defects of men of faith. But take Hebrews 11 and its long list of faithful men and women together, and there is hardly a name in that list for which the Bible does not furnish us some description of significant, embarrassing weakness and failure. From the beginning of the Bible to the end, we are in this way taught not to put our trust in men, or even in princes, even believing men and believing princes. God must save us, and to make sure that we never forget that we're never seriously tempted to put our trust elsewhere, the Lord shows us over and over again with punishing repetition how much even the best of men are a broken reed if we must lean on them for life and for salvation. Several lessons are compressed in this characteristic feature of all the narratives of the judges that will follow. The one is that it is necessary that we learn to take with full seriousness our own shortcomings and those of others. Clearly, there's a penchant on our part to think that we do not really need the Lord for this or for that, that we or others can do for us what must be done. There would not be so much of this sad disclosure of moral frailty and failure if it were not necessary to counteract a tendency on our part to count on men more than we should. And of course, we're given this same warning explicitly, directly, over and over again in the Bible, precisely because we are so susceptible to this error. Stop trusting in man who has but a breath in his nostrils. Of what account is he? Isaiah 2, verse 22. But man, despite his riches, does not endure. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the fate of those who trust in themselves. That's Psalm 49. Verses 12 and 13, and many texts like those. Time and again, the Lord tells his people that they are trusting in the wrong thing, and in one way or another, that their false trust is a trust that is placed in men, either other men or themselves. It makes a valuable exercise for us to ask ourselves from time to time just how we might be committing that error and that sin, in what ways we are not really, honestly, genuinely trusting the Lord for what we need, but looking to ourselves, to one another, to others, even to great men. In what way am I looking to man, to myself, for what only God can give me and only God can guarantee me? When we read of Barak and of God's deliverance of Israel through him, we are reminded that the men who appear in the narrative succeed only because God was with them. It's God who gives the victory, and he gives it ordinarily in spite of the man he uses, not really because of him. The other lesson is that we must be careful to give glory to God for what he has done and given, which this narrator is very careful to do at the beginning and in the middle and at the end of his narrative of the life and career of Barak. It's easy enough to fail to do this. We can see men. We can see the processes by which something comes to us, a job or a raise, a wife or husband, a child, some particular blessing or provision, some deliverance from a difficulty or a problem. But we cannot see God. We cannot see his hand. We cannot see him giving us this gift. This is the constant struggle of faith. It's where we live every moment of every day to remember that God is the source and the cause of every good thing that we enjoy. Every thoughtful Christian knows how often he or she forgets this. even in matters where we have prayed earnestly. Once the blessing comes, it is so easy to forget whence that blessing came and to whom we owe our thanks and our love for it. Barak is a lesson in faith in God, pure and simple, a lesson in the importance of looking right past what we can see to the God who is there and at work, even though we cannot see him. It's what we are to do every hour of every day through our pilgrimage in this world, until we are finally where there will be no possibility of ever failing to appreciate that all things are to him and from him and for him.